site's ready, and constructed. I guess they know in terms of the most around ones of civil law that I've never seen to vanish here after that, but anyway, let's go to our next case, case number 59940, Russell L. Knight and Revenue Plus LLC Appellants versus Las Vegas Land Partners LLC and all respondents, Mr. Posenberg for the appellants, Mr. Sterling for the respondents. Mr. Posenberg, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. Dan Posenberg for Rusty Knight. In this case, the respondent, Las Vegas Land Partners, hired Rusty Knight expressly not to be involved in a real estate deal, but to find investors for its development projects. But then, later, temporarily, the transaction was characterized as a real estate deal, and so Las Vegas Land Partners brought this case in the district court for a declaratory judgment that Rusty is not entitled to any compensation, saying that it falls under NRS 645, which prohibits compensation on a real estate transaction if the person does not have a real estate broker's license. Well, their analysis is wrong. They're starting with the idea that this was ultimately a real estate transaction. Well, that's
just factually how this case, it did go through some twists and turns in terms of how it started, his relationship and co-relationship, senior relationship.
It did. And I don't think any of that matters here for Judge Israel's decision. He decided it on a technicality, believing their argument that if it is ultimately manifested as a real estate transaction, then that's it. It falls under Chapter 645.
Understanding that, though, looking at this, when it started, it was a founding investor.
Yes, absolutely was.
My understanding of the written documents or whatever. We later got into a situation, I know, that kind of the written documents were out the window.
Let me go through the facts, and I know it's unusual that we have to, but this case is highly factual, although most of the facts probably aren't entitled to all the inferences because it's simply a summary judgment standard. What happened was, starting in 2005, Las Vegas Land Partners went to Rusty Knight and wanted him to be involved. They had 5 blocks of real estate in the redevelopment area in downtown Las Vegas. They wanted to find a partner. They didn't have the ability or the resources to develop this land. And so they went to Rusty, and he was involved at some point with another company as well, First Wall Street. And that was the written contract. Now, Las Vegas Land Partners fell out of favor with First Wall Street and entered into an agreement directly with Rusty Knight for him to do all the developing, rather, for him to find a partner for them to do the developing. And they repeatedly, 17 times they characterized this as an oral contract. Well, we don't have a statute of frauds issue, and besides, there could be no dispute about the contract with Rusty Knight. We have a series of emails entering into it. We have ratification from Las Vegas Land Partners saying he did the work, he deserves to be compensated, he deserves to be richly compensated. But then ultimately, there's a letter of interest, a letter of intent signed in June of 2006 between Las Vegas Land Partners, and the primary objective of this development partnership, the seeking out a joint venture, which was Forest City. And in fact, Forest City is expressly named in the written contract as somebody that they're looking for. And in that letter of intent, it is to develop this as a joint venture, exactly what we've been talking about all along. And everything that Rusty Knight did was to do that. Now, a year later, in June 2007, they enter into a purchase and sale agreement that makes it look like it's a real estate transaction. And the reason they do this is because Forest City has sold some businesses that were involved in assisted living that had a great deal of real estate involved. So they wanted to take advantage of a 1031 exchange and defer the tax consequences. It's in the record, we put it in a footnote in our brief, and that's the only reason that it was a real estate transaction. At the same time, if you look at the purchase and sale agreement, however, it looks like a joint venture agreement. At the same time they entered into the purchase and sale agreement, they entered into a management agreement, which does set out that they're going to operate this like a joint venture agreement. and that Forest City is going to be entitled to 60% of the profits of the development. Now, if that weren't enough, after enough time has gone by that they don't have to worry about the 1031 exchange, they do redo this entire transaction as a joint venture, set up an LLC, they contribute, both parties contribute their interest in the real estate to the LLC, Forest City puts in over another $50 million of more money, giving them 90% of the joint venture. So they're wrong in saying that you look to the ultimate transaction, and I'll go through the legal analysis in a moment, but even then they're factually wrong on what the ultimate transaction was. The transaction ultimately was a joint venture. They come in and you say you look only at the ultimate transaction, or as they said, what was ultimately entered into. No, they don't. There are three things you can look at. You can look at the agreement between the parties, Las Vegas Land Partners and Rusty Knight, as to what he was supposed to do. You can look at what he actually did, his actions, his conduct, his services to Las Vegas Land Partners, and then you can look at what ultimately, what form the transaction took. Although, I don't know of any courts that look only at that unless the statute requires that. And our statute does not. Let's look first at what the agreement was. And Justice Douglas brought that up. The original agreement was for Las Vegas Land Partners to have Rusty come in and find somebody to invest in this real estate development. It was expressly set out that way. So the California courts look first to the relationship, and we win under the relationship. Most courts look at least to the conduct involved. And I would submit that that's what this court does. In Islandia, there was a case where there was a real estate contract to begin with, a real estate sale entered into, but this court reversed summary judgment and said you just can't look at the beginning and the end because the statute itself looks at the conduct. So you have to look at the conduct that's required. Now, since I'm a newborn textualist, let's look at the type of conduct that is involved in 645.030. It says to violate the statute, you have to sell real estate, you have to negotiate the sale of real estate, or you have to solicit prospective purchasers. They argue that Rusty sold the real estate because he went to Forest City and talked about the value that it had. Well, no. That's not selling. Going to somebody to be involved in investing in the development, you address certain things. You address the traffic patterns involved. You address different things other than the value of the property. You look at the potential value of development. Rusty went in and did financial analysis for them. He didn't do the things that real estate brokers do. He didn't list the property. He didn't find comps for them. He looked at this as a development, not a mere sale. And he was not involved in the sale.
Mr. Polson, Your Honor. Did he induce individuals to invest in, i.e., purchase land?
Not into purchasing land. That's the third part of the statute, and that is, did he solicit prospective purchasers? Now, both soliciting and the word prospective have an element of intent or knowledge or anticipation or expectation. He was involved in investors, but not in purchasers. Nothing that he did, and certainly not on the summary judgment standard, had to do with soliciting them as purchasers. He was only looking at them as investors. And so he didn't even try, and they don't make much of that in their brief. They try to focus mainly on the selling. So none of this conduct, and we have an expert witness, and we've got the Knott report in there that says what Rusty did isn't what a real estate broker does. And so I think we would win this as a matter of law, but certainly they don't win this as a matter of law.
Mr. Holzman, in Mr. Knife's causes of action, his complaint, does he have an alternative cause of action for quantum merit?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And assuming there was no written contract, I know that's an issue with the emails and all that, but did he have a right to pursue the claim for quantum merit?
Absolutely, and I don't really think that his remedy is an issue on this appeal. They repeatedly say that we argue that we should get 4% of $82 million, as if we were arguing for a real estate commission. There's nothing in our briefs or in the briefing below on the summary judgment where we were arguing what the exact compensation is that we get. Plus, let's remember, Forest City also invested in an additional $50 million. So we're not talking about $82 million, we're talking about $130 million. So actually how to resolve that is not an issue in front of this court. But I think they bring that up repeatedly to make it look like it's a real estate commission. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I was just going to say, this is an action for summary judgment, and I'm listening to your argument, so how did the district court, from your standpoint, get off course and base their decision on the application of 645?
Unfortunately, Las Vegas Land Partners had an easy argument, a technical argument, but it was deficient. They say if it ultimately results in a real estate transaction, then it is a real estate transaction, and you cannot get compensated for it unless you have a real estate broker's license. Islandia itself would preclude summary judgment on that analysis. Thank you, and I'd like to save my 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Mr. Scully, on behalf of the respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, this wasn't a real estate transaction. Mr. Pilsenberg has done a fair job of characterizing our argument. If it ends as a real estate transaction, then it's a real estate transaction. You need to be licensed as a broker or a salesman.
If somebody does all this work, I guess it's alleged, we haven't got into the trial part, but Mr. Knight did all this work, and it was finally potentially a real estate transaction at the end. Is he just out of luck for all this other work was done when the transaction was supposed to be structured a different way initially?
He is out of luck, Your Honor, just as other people have been out of luck in prior cases from this court, in the Ms. V. Lane case. For example, the broker, even if he does some work, and actually it's undisputed in this case that Mr. Knight did bring these parties together and did do considerable work, and my clients did say he should be compensated for that. But he was working at the time under an agreement with another party, and that was the party that actually contracted with my client for the services. Our position is that he should be paid by that entity. That's what the agreement said. He was going to get a percentage of what we owed that other entity on First Wall Street. We don't have to pay him directly. He should be paid, but there should only be one commission in this case. And in fact, my clients were sued by that other entity, and when we settled that, there's not much of it in the record, but it is mentioned.
Why isn't this, so I understand you're arguing the statute's an issue of law, and you raised that in the motion for summary judgment, but it sounds like there's some mixed issues of fact and law in this whole case, and should the trier fact just be able to delve into the whole situation to sort this out?
We do think that this is a case that's appropriate for summary judgment. There are a lot of facts that are disputed and not clear. But the important facts, the dispositive facts, are undisputed. That ultimately, there was a sale of real estate. The documents are in the record showing that. Mr. Pilsenberg says it's a temporarily real estate transaction, but the fact of the matter is there was a transfer of an interest in real property that was the result of what Mr. Knight did that he's claiming a commission on. And I do want to qualify just a little bit.
Is he claiming a commission or is he claiming damages for breach of an agreement? What exactly is this theory before the district court that you were able to persuade the judge to grant summary judgment?
When you talk about a commission, Mr. Pilsenberg is correct that it's not briefed that way. But we rely on his deposition testimony, and when you read the deposition testimony, he's clearly anticipating a percentage of the sale, and that certainly looks like a commission to us. But what you call it is important under the statute as an ultimate decision of this court, because you get a commission for a real estate transaction. And that's kind of what I wanted to back up a little bit and qualify that statement about you have to be a broker if ultimately it ends in a real estate transaction. Well, that's true, but you don't just look at whether it ends in a real estate transaction. You still have to go back and look at the acts that the person claiming the commission or whatever you want to call it did that he's claiming compensation for. And we think that what he did in bringing the parties together, in soliciting parties, in developing materials to make the property attractive, even if at the time he wasn't intending that to result in a real estate transaction, that is in fact selling the property if in the end it ultimately results in a sale of that property. And again, when we talk about fairness, Mr. Knight had a way of protecting himself here. Obviously, he could have been a real estate broker, he wouldn't be in this situation. But initially, it appears that he did partner with an entity or have an arrangement with another entity, First Wall Street. And I think part of the intention of that may have been to have a licensed real estate broker involved in this transaction or in this process so that, so to speak, if it ended up as a real estate transaction, they would still be able to claim.
So you chose Wall Street, you have a broker partner, is a licensed real estate company?
Well, actually, Your Honor, it turned out that they didn't, and this is something that's discussed in the briefs, because Mr. Knight, in a email exchange with my clients, made a big point about the fact that First Wall Street did not have a real estate license, and so my clients should not be afraid that they would be sued by First Wall Street if they didn't pay First Wall Street a commission based on the ultimate sale. So Mr. Knight was aware. In fact, I believe it's in the record that he was formerly licensed in New York, so he's not unfamiliar with these processes.
Formerly licensed as a real estate broker?
I believe so, Your Honor. If he was to be paid, we're not saying he shouldn't be paid. He did do some commendable and some valuable work here, but commission should come from First Wall Street, or should come from there under the statute.
The judge, I assume, granted summary judgment on the whole case. It wasn't a partial summary judgment. So if it's affirmed, under law of the case, Mr. Knight would not be able to go back against your clients to seek any recovery.
No, Your Honor. And I mean, that was a separate proceeding, and it settled, and there was a release of all claims with First Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
I think the important point here, and we're getting sort of into the details, which is important, but Mr. Poulsenberg was correct, and we do have the easy argument here, which is simply that you look at the statute, and the statute very clearly says that in order to bring or maintain an action for a commission based on the sale of real property, you have to have the appropriate license. Our argument is that the circumstances here, one, the fact that it ultimately involved the sale of property, regardless of the initial intention, and two, that if you look at the acts that he performed, they are the acts listed in the statute under 645.030 as indicators or factors under the definition of what being a broker is. And so our argument is very simple. You apply the statute, you apply the plain meaning of the statute, and when you do so, it results in his inability to collect a commission, and more specifically, it requires the dismissal of his lawsuit, which is what the statute is expressly directed at.
And Mr. Stratton, I thought about this kind of scenario in this case. It's very interesting, in how you interpret the statutes. But if you, let's say, a business broker represented somebody in the sale of a business, let's say it's like a McDonald's franchise, it's a business, an ongoing business entity, but it owns real estate. I guess, so the buyer is buying the real estate plus the business itself, so it's kind of a mixed situation here. How would you interpret the statute for that type of scenario?
Well, I mean, in fact, Your Honor, those cases come up, and they've cited some of them in their brief, and we've distinguished those on the grounds that if you're purchasing the business, and the transaction is set up as the sale of the business, the fact that it collaterally involves some transfers of property, that does not necessarily implicate the real estate statutes, although that's not an issue that's been decided here in Nevada, certainly. The difference here is that we have the entity, First City, actually taking a transfer of the real property. We have the deed of trust in the record, the grant bargain sale deed in the record, and it shows an actual transfer of the property, and there may have been tax reasons for doing it or setting it up that way, but for our purposes, and certainly on summary judgment, that's not important. It's not relevant. All that's relevant is that, in fact, the entity, the transaction that ultimately resulted based on Ms. Knipe's activities is a real estate transaction, and that's undisputed. But the fact that there's a real estate transaction.
The final transaction was simply a conveyance of real property, and that's it.
It wasn't the final. There were other things that were done after that. I'm not exactly familiar, but there was, Mr. Polsenberg alluded to it, LLC transactions, some other entities that were set up, that sort of thing. But the transaction that generated the money here was the transaction that involved the transfer of the property. Other things were done after that point.
Are there any equitable defenses here in this case, or is this one of the affirmative defenses? I'm trying to determine if there's any factual issue, mixed issues of law and fact, or do you think it's just strictly controlled by Chapter 645? That's it.
No, it's strictly controlled by the statute, and that's why quantum merit really isn't an issue here. That issue has come up before in this state. It was in Loomis v. Lang, as I recall, from my law clerk days at the court. That you can't get quantum merit as a way of evading the real estate statutes. And that is pretty well established. It's the rule that should be followed by this court. There's been talk of public policy in the brief, in the opening brief, that we should be concerned about the implications of this decision, if it's affirmed, might have on the real estate market development in Nevada and Clark County and that sort of thing. We've rebutted that by pointing out that if you want to talk about public policy, you should talk about the public policy that the legislature of Nevada has actually adopted and recognized, and that's the public policy expressed in these statutes, that although they can sometimes be harsh, are quite clear as to what's required, and if they're not complied with, that you don't get paid, and in fact you can't even bring a lawsuit. And this court has recognized that rule on time to time when it comes up, recognized that the purpose of these statutes is the protection of the public. That it's important that the people involved in these transactions are licensed so that the appropriate board or authority can monitor these people, make sure they're complying with the statutes and the rules and the ethical requirements and that sort of thing.
Was there any allegation that your client knew Mr. Knipe wasn't a licensed real estate broker and then but continued to let him work on and on doing things with the intent, or was the allegation was that they weren't going to pay him at the end anyway?
I'm not specifically on your mind. I don't recall from the record.
I just don't know if that's an issue.
There's certainly the allegation or the insinuation in the briefing here and down below that my clients acted in an oppressive manner and took advantage of this poor fellow and that sort of thing. But, you know, again, he was licensed in New York. He obviously has a sophisticated understanding of complex financial transactions and that sort of thing. So I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say that somehow my client was taking advantage of him. I think for a good portion of the relationship, We recognize that he provided valuable services, and we got along. It was only when things broke down, when there were issues with the other entity suing for bringing a lawsuit against us, that sort of thing. And it looked like we were going to have to pay out not just one commission, but two. But things really broke down, and at that point, we're entitled to rely on the statute.
Well, Mr. Knight wasn't brought into their lawsuit like as a third-party defendant, cross-defendant, or whatever, by your client after your client was sued by whoever's other company is.
I'm not familiar with the details of the other suit. Because
is it in Nevada, this other suit?
I believe it was in New York, but I could be mistaken.
Okay.
But it was not part of this lawsuit, other than that there was mention in the briefs and in the record that that matter had settled. There had been a release, and there was a payment made by my clients to First Wall Street, which I believe is the name of the entity.
I guess the other question I had, Mr. Sherman, again, we're kind of exploring the issues here. It is a summary judgment, so I realize both sides are limited with the record, but we know we had that case about a licensed contractor. You have to be a licensed contractor to enforce a mechanics lien or different things, but I think we had a case that said that an owner knew so the contractor wasn't licensed and said, don't worry, I'll pay you anyway, just go do the work, and the person did the work, and he said at the end, oh, I got you, you're not licensed, goodbye. And I think this court said that you can't do that. I don't know if that happened in this case, but what's your thoughts on that?
That didn't happen in this case, and whenever you have a harsh rule, there's always a tendency from time to time for the court to sort of relax the rule a little bit or be tempted to do so, and that does come into the cases from time to time, but the overwhelming movement is towards the direction of strictly enforcing these statutes because of their importance. And once you open the door or the floodgates, then really anybody can claim a commission ultimately for bringing people together. And that's why I'm not just by the
numbers. Any questions from the justices for Mr. Sterling? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sterling. This is Mr. Balzenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. Here's how things broke down. Things broke down because when this deal fell apart at one point after Mr. Knight put it together, and he put it back together for Las Vegas Land Partners. And they were so thrilled. They said, you deserve to be richly compensated. You deserve to have a long-term position with us. And when the deal was finalized, then they started changing what they were going to pay him. First, they were only going to put $1 million into escrow. Then they were only going to put $700,000 into escrow. Then they only put $430,000 into escrow. And then they sued in Nevada, saying, you can't get anything because of this statute. And this is a situation where they did try to stiff him. Absolutely. Now, I don't blame Forest City, because Forest City did it as a real estate transaction only for the tax benefits, and only did it so long as they needed to do it. And even the argument that they made to Judge Israel is factually wrong. This was not, and what they said in their brief is, the contract ultimately entered into should define what this is. But the contract ultimately entered into here was not a real estate transaction. It was a joint venture. And they come in here with arguments that I honestly have to say are new for this appeal. The statement of the issue presented says that Rusty should be precluded from bringing an action claiming a commission because this is the sale of real property. Now they're saying, well, Rusty should be paid, but should be paid by somebody else. Well, and Justice Douglas and I already went through that. There was an agreement that Las Vegas Land Partners had with First Wall Street. They fired First Wall Street, and they hired Rusty. There's no reason that Rusty should have to go against First Wall Street. They said in the district court in their briefing that you look at the transaction, and now they're saying you look at the acts. I say look at the acts.
And what about Mr. Sterling's comment that your client advised
yes,
the respondents that they didn't have to pay First Wall Street because they're not licensed? Seems to indicate that if that's a true statement, that he's acknowledging a licensing requirement.
Well, first of all, you're talking about a New York license, because Rusty was licensed in New York as a real estate salesman at the time, and did say if we needed a broker he could do it through a broker. But a false assumption of law isn't binding on the party. And Las Vegas Land Partners and Rusty realized soon after that you do not need a broker, a real estate broker, to be able to do the sale of a business. And we set out all those cases, the Fifth Circuit case, the Southern District of New York case, the California cases on pages 26 and 27 of our brief. And First Wall Street sued Las Vegas Land Partners in New York, and the New York court said, no, they don't need a broker's license, because this isn't the sale of real estate. And so that, his passing comment that everybody agreed later was wrong, soon afterwards, long before this lawsuit, can't be a judicial admission. Let me just cover the acts here, and I think the cases on page 26 and 27 will do that. Let me, in my last minute, go over the two Nevada cases. Las Vegas Land Partners relies on Loomis. Loomis is a completely different situation. Everybody agreed in Loomis that it had to do with the sale of real property. That was the original agreement. That was the end result. The only question there was, did the people who do the actual work, were they licensed? And this court said, didn't have to get into the issue of what acts were done or whether they contemplated real estate. But this court did have to do that in Islandia, where there was a contract to hire somebody to help with the real estate transaction, and the ultimate transaction was a real estate transaction. And this court still reversed summary judgment and said you have to look at the acts involved and the conduct involved. We have set out in our brief why the conduct here has to do with putting together a joint venture as opposed to putting together a real estate deal. We have an expert's opinion in there, a real estate broker who explains that this is a real estate broker's deal. This is not summary judgment. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you both very much for your excellent work and all arguments and briefs, and we will take this matter under submission, and we will be in recess. We'll call the court tomorrow.